Good evening, everyone. I want to thank you for coming. Again, this is for the Annapolis Water Reclamation Facility and Odor Control Progress Update. We'll go ahead and start with introductions. Again, I'm Chris Biggerstaff. I'm the project manager for Anne Arundel County for the Odor Control Project at Annapolis. With me from Anne Arundel County, we have Beth O'Connell back there, Aaron Day, Matt Deal. Oh, sorry, let me do some titles and all that. Beth O'Connell is our director for the Bureau of Engineering. Aaron Day is our assistant director for DPW. Matt Deal is our customer relations. Terry Winslow back there is also customer relations. Dave Kramer is wastewater operations manager. Andrew Dworsis is the team manager at Annapolis. Chris Murphy up here is engineer administrator for utility engineering. Kelly Duffy is representing RK&K here. Lisa McIntosh is our toxicologist, correct? And sorry, I forgot.
John Whitelove from Tidewater and Jason Goff here with Tidewater.
Okay. And we do not have anyone tonight from Annapolis City, RK&K, and then Ms. Lisa Rodman.
From
County Council and all that, and she's going to give a brief presentation.
I'm Lisa Rodman, and I really just wanted to share some good news. The county executive's budget is going to be introduced on actually a week from tomorrow. Thursday, May 1st is the day the budget is introduced, and the fix is funded. And so, be fighting to the death if any of my colleagues try and somehow remove it from the budget when the county council gets it, but I don't think they will. I think they understand that this is important, so I just wanted to share that. And Rob Savage would ordinarily be here, but I think it's okay if I share. It's his wife's birthday, so I feel like he's a good excuse. And so David Duba, who is also works with Rob Savage and I, is here on his behalf. So thank you for all coming out, and hopefully we can get whatever these folks have. You know, you guys are the experts. Tell us what we need to do, and we'll get it done.
Awesome. Thank you very much. So moving on for the outline, first I'm going to give an upgrade on the phase two project. So that's the current project going on at the wastewater plant now. We'll give a quick odor control progress update, what we've done to date and what we're about to do. We'll briefly discuss the MD permit appeal and all that many of you are aware about. We'll then go into the summary of the findings by the toxicologist, so Lisa will then take over and give you all the findings, and then we'll give you an updated schedule and the next steps. Again, we want to kind of bring up the website, this QR code here. If you take a picture of that, go to the website. You can also sign up, and we have email updates. Several of you have signed up and all that. We'd like more for you. That way you get updates and all that. We'll be sending updates probably about once a month, and then once we start the monitoring, which we'll be talking about, the continuous monitoring, we'll be doing that once monthly as well. So the phase two upgrade, currently we're excavating for the underground pipe for the new clarifier. So here you can kind of see the excavation for the new clarifier there. So we got to put the pipe in before we can start building on top of it. The concrete structure, pouring and pumping is scheduled. We're approximately 6 weeks out from now for starting that. And the dewatering the excavation site. So that's an ongoing activity, but that is being monitored, reported, and in compliance with the MDE standards. So the odor control improvements progress. So continuous monitoring has been initiated. So you may have seen those back in the community and all that. So we sent those out to get recalibrated. Now they're back in the community, probably going on a week and a half now and stuff like that. So the first report will be posted on the website on May 9th, and again, we'll send out an email update. We probably won't do it every time going forward, but the first one, we'll let you know it's on there and stuff like that. So again, it's only gonna cover a couple weeks in April at this point, but moving forward, it'll be monthly and stuff. So the grit screen scrubber repair has been completed. So that's another yay and stuff like that. So however, we'll call it 85%. The last piece of that is the chemical feed system and all that. So that's what feeds the chemical in to kind of make that go up in compliance and all that and kind of eliminate all the odor out of that. So the contractor is going to be starting on that in early May. Hopefully by the end of May, that's completely done. So then moving on for the design for the overall improvements and all that. So we finished the schematic design. And the areas of focus, again, are the influent pump station, the grit and screen building, the primary clarifiers, and the gravity sludge thickeners. So if you remember from our previous monitoring, those were the highest readings we got at the ones outside of the mud well, which we're about to talk about. So the denitrification mud well update. So we have a two-phase approach for this. Phase one is remove, replace, and reduce. Remove existing grit from the tank. So right now there's existing grit, it kind of just settles there. Replace the broken valve to provide a better flushing process. So at the end of this green, kind of the south end of the green, there's a valve there and all that that's currently broken and all that. So we're gonna be replacing that. And then reduce the size of the mud well to allow less grit. So again, you see two red boxes there. Right now, those are open as well. So we're gonna cut those out and reduce it to just the green area and all that. So that way it allows less water and grit to settle overall. So that's phase one. We're hoping to get started with that in the next month or so. Phase two is cover, coat, and control. So we're gonna cover that remaining green area, the mud well area there. We're gonna coat the mud well so it allows for better cleaning so the grit won't stick to the bottom of the mud well and get out. And then the odor control unit will then suck from the top of that and take all that and treat the air from that. So it'll contain pretty much that whole area in green. And the red areas will no longer be used. So phase two is gonna be probably a little later this year. The problem with that one is the supplies we have to get and all that. They are very long lead items, some of them 6 months. So that's later this year. So air scour. So this was another big one brought up. So the silencer has arrived. There's a picture of it. It actually just came in Monday.
Beautiful.
So that is that loud, what you hear, jet engine noise and stuff like that. So this is to help eliminate that. Installation is scheduled for mid-May, so they need to pour a concrete pad and install a support structure. So they're going to be starting on that hopefully in the next week or two and stuff like that. So they got to get some supplies, but hopefully mid-May we're looking to have that installed. So okay, MDE permit appeal. So to kind of go over this one, so as we said from the very beginning, we disagree with the MDE that the air quality requirements belong in a wastewater discharge permit. We also disagree with the language. We believe it's very vague. We question, where did the 30 ppb limit originate from? They gave us no documentation of where they came up with that number. Where should the monitors be located? How many monitors are required? So all this information, we don't know how to comply with this. And then what are the compliance requirements for that and stuff? So that's some of the appeals we're going for. And the other reason we're appealing is no other wastewater NPDES permit controlled by MDE has this language included. So no other MDE permit has this language. So we're questioning why it's just our facility.
Can you spell out some of these initialisms?
Yeah, so MDE is Maryland Department of Environment. And then NPDES is National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. So it's basically the EPA's kind of regulation for pollution control. And it's not just wastewater, it's also stormwater discharge. So
what part of this don't you agree with so that we can understand?
So we don't agree with this being part of a wastewater discharge permit. So our permit currently is just for wastewater discharge. It looks at the quality of the wastewater, the liquid water that we are discharging. It doesn't include any other air quality, anything like that. And that's why we're questioning why it's included in this permit.
It's included because maybe yours is the one that stinks the most. I don't get it why you're saying cut back on the regulations and we're trying to solve what apparently is a pretty big problem.
I understand, and we're still working on solutions for that and all that, but we don't agree it should be in a wastewater discharge permit.
Chris, so can I just add something? I understand it's not in other MDE discharge permits. However, it is in discharge permits in other states.
Cool.
So, this isn't anything terribly unusual that MDE is asking.
So we have asked MDE for that information we've not received.
Oh, okay, good.
It's slippery slope. So MDE added this to the permit, not because of any qualitative measures that they have taken. They've added it to the permit as a result of your emails, which we respect that. This is our response to those emails. We hope that our response is a more effective solution and just don't want, it's a slippery slope to allow things into permits that weren't quantitative.
I'm just saying, in some cases, I'm thinking of Washington State, of a couple of counties, where the counties actually issue the discharge permit. So it's different in different states, and in those cases, it has to do with accountability. Who will hold you accountable?
So that is why we're here, here tonight. I don't believe, as far as I know, there's no one here from MDE in a formal capacity, but we're here, and we are trying to demonstrate the accountability that we have. We have projects underway, funding underway. We would just like the opportunity to fix it without it becoming a regulatory issue that is going to be costly and could even be difficult to meet the reporting requirements that they're asking for. Not the odor requirements, but the reporting requirements that they're asking for.
So if the 30 ppb is what you consider too high, what is your proposal back to MDE? What level is acceptable for you?
So we haven't said that's unacceptable. We're trying to come out, find where they found that limit from, or why they chose that one. We're trying to find more information from them of why they chose that limit. So,
you're saying that's not attainable? Is that the engineering isn't attainable?
From our research, it's going to be very hard and stuff. It's the technology may not be there. What we're finding.
Can I bring up another concern for you? You have two pump out stations that are also odoriferous, whatever the word is. Do you have monitors around those? Because those are equally horrific as far as the odor. And can we get some remediation? Is there any plan to do that at this stage?
I'm not aware of any plan at this point. I can work with Dave, and I'm sure we could put an odor monitor there or something like that
I would have to think that some days are really bad, some days are not bad at all.
Okay.
Why does that happen? Why is there inconsistency? What is the item of the engineering behind that?
So some of it's heat and humidity usually raises that quality. Right. So usually, like, come summertime, the odor almost always increases and stuff like
it
that.
It does.
So
it doesn't mean that every day is bad
still.
And it seems to be, I don't know, like something that could be re-engineered, like you're doing this, maybe a little bit of money, I don't know. So I'd like to start a conversation on that also, not stay away from this group at this
time. Okay.
I just ask a quick clarification. Is it the pump stations within the community, or
yes,
is it a pump out at the tree?
Pump stations to the big plant.
Within the community?
There is.
Okay.
Within, yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
I need a conversation.
And it's the Chesapeake Harbor community, just to clarify.
No. We're across the street over on the other side of Back Creek. King James Landing is the one pump out station. And I understand there's another one. I don't understand.
There's two within Chesapeake Harbor, and that's why I'm guess questioning, because yours may be in Napa City owned and operated. So
it probably is.
So well, King James is in Napa City.
Okay, so we could bring that information up to Napa City, but they would have to take it at that point, just because we don't control that station and stuff like that. But,
yeah.
We'll relay that information to them. Yeah.
So. Can I be clear? We have an air quality issue here. Are you saying that you are opposing any air quality requirements? Is this, because that seems pretty weird.
No, this is a discharge permit. This is the permit that regulates the pollution that's in the water that's discharged.
So it's an overall environmental issue, and I'm just trying to find out you're saying that you don't want any air quality requirements as part of that? In other words, we're just here to what?
Correct. We do not want air quality requirements in the discharge permit.
It's a water quality permit. It's not an air emissions permit. So
our issue though is environmental. And when you start to bureaucratically divide off and say, well, air doesn't count, I've got a strong intellectual problem with that.
We hear your concerns, and we're trying to address them.
Are there separate air quality permits then that you have to apply for?
MDE
has air quality permits. There's not an odor control limit in the MDE air quality permit for this facility in Maryland, but there is an air quality department provision in MDE.
So can you break this down to layman's terms? Because I'm trying to understand when we're talking about
the quality of the water and the, I guess the stinkiness of the water itself. Are you saying that that stinky water is not present in the air, the smell from that?
I think all we're trying to say is that this particular permit where MD put this language in, they put it in a water permit, which it's, this permit is 20 pages long, and it's got all these things that you test the water for. And it's very clear, like, how many days a week, how you sample. When MD put this in, and I'm speaking from a design engineer's point, it's the first time we've ever seen air. Like, people don't exactly know how to test. It doesn't say how often. It doesn't say how often you have to report. It doesn't say where to put the monitors. So from a design engineer's perspective, it's been difficult for us to even say, okay, let's do this, because we don't, it's not well-defined like the water.
I would love for you guys to come out to Chesapeake Harbor at 2 o'clock in the morning when the stink is really bad and it wakes you up out of your sleep. And you're thinking, did my toilet overflow? You're gagging, your eyes are watering, and your windows aren't even open. I can tell you exactly where some of those things need to be hung.
I'm afraid that our appeal of this permit is being misconstrued as us not wanting to address the problem. We sincerely want to address the problem, and we have plans for that. That's what we're here to share with you tonight. The added language to the permit does not assist us with that. And we are actually trying to avoid the bureaucracy of adding it to a permit so that we can focus on what we know we need to do in order to design the plan.
But how would the odor be measured then? If you don't want to measure it,
saying we won't measure. We will measure. We don't want to be regulated. We don't know what the risk to us is if we violate a permit. Because a permit comes with fees and fines if you violate it, and we don't know how they're going to measure us and hold us accountable. It's very unclear in the language they've added. So we're not trying to avoid addressing the odor. We want the rules to be black and white that we can follow, and the way that it was added to the permit, again, the permit language didn't originate from discussions with us. They actually didn't even ask us what our project was. They didn't measure or have access to the data that we had from the odor. I do believe that they were trying to respond to your community's concern, which we appreciate, and we respect that, and that's why we're here, to respond to this community's concerns. We want to do it in a way that we know is effective, and we're concerned that the permit language just isn't going to get us there.
So what are you proposing that is going to address the risks to us health-wise? Because I've attended every single meeting, and I've yet to hear anything where there is any concern about our health.
So let's go ahead and take a pause on this. We have more time for questions later. Let's get into the toxicologist part so we can address those very concerns that you have. Stuff like that. So moving right on into it. Lisa, if you don't mind.
That's a great segue. Yep. Thanks, Chris.
So just hit that button to move forward. Okay. Yep.
All right. DPW hired me to evaluate the potential health risks associated with hydrogen sulfide. That's been monitored in the air over the past year. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Just a briefer, if you're new to this, these meetings, hydrogen sulfide is a colorless flammable gas that's naturally produced by bacteria, and the water reclamation facility is just chock full of those bacteria that produce hydrogen sulfide. And it's a common air contaminant that you have associated with wastewater treatment plants. So what I'm looking at today is the health risk associated with hydrogen sulfide. And I want to just go talk a little bit about the difference between odor and toxicity. So, as you know, you can smell hydrogen sulfide. You're all here because you're smelling hydrogen sulfide in the air, and that's that stinky, kind of sulfury, rotten egg smell. There are a few different terms I'd like to introduce you to. So the first is odor threshold, and that's the concentration at which you can smell a substance. And that can really depend on the person. So some people are very sensitive to odors. I hate the smell of gasoline. I have friends who love the smell of gasoline. Some people like the scent of cigarette smoke, others hate that scent. So that really is variable and depends on who you are and what your association with that odor is. There's also nuisance odors. So not only can you smell something, but it's unpleasant to you, and it's annoying enough that it bothers you and it can, you know, cause some kind of stress in your life. And then there's toxicity, which is what I'm going to be talking about in the following slides. And that's the concentration where you're exposed to a contaminant. Okay. Can anybody hear me okay, by the way? So toxicity is when something actually is toxic to you. It can cause some kind of damage. So that's different from a nuisance odor where you might smell something, it's unpleasant, you don't like it, but it's not causing some kind of adverse reaction in your body, like some kind of damage. So just to kind of go into that a little bit further, we talk about odor thresholds. We're looking at a very wide range. So here we have half a part per billion. So that's one part in a billion parts. So very, very small amount, ranging all the way up to 300 parts per billion. So, you know, we have several orders of magnitude difference. And that, again, that really goes back to, what your tolerance for that odor is. Do you find it pleasant? Do you find it unpleasant? Do you have a bad association with it? There's actually a psychological component to that. So if you've had a bad experience in the past, you're going to be more sensitive to odors than somebody who didn't have that. Nuisance odors are what, you know, you're experiencing likely in the area. So you have odors that don't smell pleasant. They might cause a headache or maybe a little bit of irritation to your eyes or your throat. Maybe they make you feel a little queasy. They're stressing you out. So that's what we're considering nuisance odors. And then again, there's toxic effects. So for hydrogen sulfide, the toxic effects are varied, but they essentially affect your cardiovascular system and your neurological system. And in extremely high concentrations, it can cause death. Those concentrations are well above anything that you're experiencing in the neighborhood. And just for reference, I have up, I don't know if I have a little pointer up here. I don't know. Anyway, background concentrations of hydrogen sulfide from any natural source is pretty much below the range of the odor threshold. So hydrogen sulfide will be present in the air at any given time, but often you can't smell it. So what I'm here to talk about is the health risk assessment that I did. And so a risk assessment is a tool that environmental scientists use to determine the need for action. And that risk assessment evaluates how much somebody is exposed and compares that to some kind of threshold dose, and that gives you an idea of whether there's a potential for an adverse effect to happen from a contaminant. So it's really asking, you know, who is exposed, to what are they exposed to, where are they exposed, what's the location where they're exposed, how often are they exposed? That's what the risk assessment seeks to answer. And then I just want to reiterate that it's a tool. It does not tell you what your actual risk is from a contaminant. It doesn't look at health effects on a particular person or a specific population of people. It's really just a tool that looks at an estimate of exposure and compares that to an estimate of toxicity. It combines that information and it comes up with a conclusion whether those concentrations of a contaminant are likely to pose a risk or not. Is that clear? So going back a little bit, these are the hydrogen sulfide air monitors that are around the reclamation facility and the neighborhood. Around the treatment plant, we have part per million monitors because the concentrations of hydrogen sulfide are much higher around the processes there. And then in the neighborhood areas, we have a part per billion monitor. So this is measuring concentrations that could be potentially a thousandfold lower than the monitors around the building. And that's because the concentrations are much lower around in the neighborhood compared to the facility. And here's a map, and there's a map over there on the board that you can look at later if you'd like. This just shows the locations of all the different monitors. So we have monitors, 10 different monitors right around the facility, a few at the fence line. Most of them are around the actual facility processes. And then we have 5 different part per billion monitors in the neighborhood. And that's those are the blue circles you see there, so 1 through 5. And so we had 2 at the marina, 1 at the Maritime Museum to the north, and then 2 in the Chesapeake Harbor neighborhood. And so the data generated from those monitors last summer, when the monitors were deployed, show that hydrogen sulfide is present in the air, but its detection is very variable and very infrequent, actually. So you see here we have detection frequency of hydrogen sulfide at the 5 different locations, and we're really looking at 5% or less of the time that these monitors are picking up hydrogen sulfide as a positive detection, which is interesting.
Sorry, can you tell us what marina that is? Is that Bert Damon?
That's Damon across the street.
Yes, from, okay.
Yeah, yes. So good.
Across from Edgewood.
Yeah.
4 and 5.
So that's a function of the wind blowing, isn't that correct?
So these monitors run, they record measurements every 10 minutes, and they're deployed continuously over, is it 2 months maybe worth of data, July to August. So they're really set up to evaluate changes in concentration over time. So, you know, you could have a breeze blowing from the north one part of the day, breeze blowing from the south the other part of the day. These monitors are intended to capture those changes in concentration over time. And then,
excuse me, on sure. The timeline that you have there, July 1st through August 13th, are those monitors still in place today?
So those are the ones we just redeployed a week and a half ago.
So there any data that comes out from, our first question would be, is there any data that comes out for August 13th through the end, and is there a time of year where you know that the concentration would be higher? Is it the summer months that are the worst? Is it also part of the fall months where it's windy or something, and it is the best time of year, the winter months? So I mean, the two questions would be any data post this date, and is there a specific time of year you expect the levels to be higher?
My risk assessment is based on the summer data. From the data that had been collected between, so at the water reclamation facility, those part per million monitors, they have data from, I think it's March, and then later, or March, April, and then later in the summer, and the summer concentrations are higher. So I feel like the summer monitoring period is really representing a time of the year when concentrations tend to be higher.
So there are no data after August 13,
2024? No, so we do not have any monitoring after that date until we started
now.
So after that date, we had to send back the monitors for recalibration and stuff like that, and then we were working to get a RKK on board to do continuous monitoring.
And what you said earlier today, is that you had them back?
Yep. They're all in the same locations and stuff like that, and they've been in about a week and a half now. So they'll be continuous now through the construction of all the odor control improvements.
Okay. Has this data been presented before today?
Yes. So it's also on the webpage that QR code is on your handout as well on the reverse side. And we did a presentation back in November, December as well to run this data.
So I'm asking about time frame. How long do you anticipate the time it will take you to eradicate the smells completely? Or do you think they will go away?
So we'll talk about that in the schedule update.
Yeah.
He's talking about the toxicologist report now, so we'll get to that a little bit.
Okay, so I mentioned earlier when we do a risk assessment, we look at how much to a contaminant someone is exposed and then compare that to some kind of toxicity threshold. So when we're looking at exposure, exposure can be either short-term, which we usually refer to as an acute exposure, or it can be long-term, so it could be, you know, over several years or a portion of your life or somewhere in between. And then we can look at the air concentrations from our monitoring data, and then we can further do adjustments if we need to account for the time somebody's present in that area. So what we did for this assessment, though, is we assumed that a person was present in their home, you know, 24 hours a day for the entire period of time. So that is a pretty conservative assumption. You know, people leave their houses typically to go to school or camp or work, go to the grocery store, whatever. But we made this, you know, just this very simple assumption that you're in your home, you're in your home throughout the entire day over the monitoring period. And so we didn't have to make any kind of adjustment to that. And then as far as the air concentrations, I mentioned this earlier, you know, the air concentrations fluctuate and these monitors take that into account by providing continuous measurements throughout the whole monitoring period. So what we do is derive what's called a time-weighted average. And because it makes it very easy when you have monitors that are collecting continuously on 10-minute increments, you're basically looking at the fluctuations over time and you're coming up with an average that's based on the number of fluctuations, the time period that those elevated concentrations occurred, and it kind of smooths it all out. So you have an average concentration that represents your average concentration over the course of that exposure period. And we also looked at the data a couple of different ways. So the monitors present the data either as a detection, so you know some numeric value, or if it does not detect hydrogen sulfide, the monitor's reported as a zero. So basically, it's either not there at all or it's detected. And so we conducted the risk assessment two ways. We treated those non-detect or those zero results as is and used those zeros in calculating our time-weighted average in addition to the detected results. And then we also, knowing that hydrogen sulfide is a typical background contaminant, so it's something that's naturally in the air, we took the upper end of a background range, what we would potentially expect to see in the air. And then we used that value in crafting our time-weighted average. So we really looked at it from just a straight average and then a slightly conservative assumption, assuming those zeros actually were not zeros, they were a background concentration. So the next step of the risk assessment process is to understand the toxicity of hydrogen sulfide and look for what we call toxicity values. These are basically benchmarks that you compare your exposure to evaluate your health risk. And again, going back to long-term and short-term exposures, there are different types of toxicity values for each type of exposure. And so the risk assessment looked at both. We looked at acute exposure, so those short-term exposures. And for those, EPA and that's the United States Environmental Protection Agency and the Agency for Toxic Substances Disease Registry, these acronyms are killers. Minimal risk levels, and we compared the results of the monitoring to those concentrations. And again, those are...
I'm sorry, are you saying this is only, you had an average, so are you testing this for the highest level of toxicity, or only after you've averaged everything out?
So...
Which would be...
So, again, you get these results on 10-minute increments. Right.
So, my question is, you said, here we go, we average everything, and that's fine. But to me, it would appear that there are times of higher toxicity, people waking up in the middle of the night, and that's where I would assume that health effects could come in. Have you, by averaging, eliminated that higher?
No, because, so again, going back to, you know, nuisance odors versus toxic effects, when we're looking at, unless you're looking at hydrogen sulfide at really high concentrations, which we're not seeing here, we're not even seeing those at at the water reclamation facility. For hydrogen sulfide and for other contaminants as well, these toxicity benchmarks are usually based on longer period of time than 10 minutes. So for example, the long-term effects that we're looking at, and which have the most stringent benchmark, this US EPA reference concentration, that's for which is called a chronic exposure. So this is exposure that could occur potentially over years. So in general, your toxicity benchmarks for long-term exposure are going to be much more conservative, much more health protective than a short-term exposure. So you can be exposed to a contaminant for a short amount of time at a higher level than if you were exposed continuously day after day, year after year. So we looked at, the focus of the risk characterization was mainly on long-term effects. So what happens if you're exposed to hydrogen sulfide for months or for years versus short-term effects? So what happens if you have these fluctuations throughout the day? Does that answer your question?
Well, let me give you a framework. I represent, I'm at Bay Woods Retirement Community, where the average, which is right just the other side of that little map, where the average age is 86, and there's a health center. So I'm just trying to find out if, for my environment, this is not the normal, these are 86-year on average, right? So is there, given the setting of this, are we at a greater risk in this community of 180 people?
Well, so going back to this EPA reference concentration, EPA, when they set these levels, they take into account sensitive subpopulations. So essentially, the young, the elderly, they're really intended to be very conservative benchmarks to be protective of a wide range of people. Now, are they protective of everybody in the world? No. But they capture a large range of the population and people who are more sensitive and people who are less sensitive. Does that answer your question? So the last part of the risk assessment is calculating a health risk. And we do this for using a method called a hazard quotient method. And it's just a simple ratio. It's your average daily exposure, so how much you're exposed, compared to your reference concentration. So that's that EPA number I just talked about. So that concentration that's protective of long-term exposures. And so when you take your time-weighted average at each of the locations and you compare it to the reference concentration, you compare it to a threshold of 1. So the assumption is, if your exposure is equal to or less than this threshold concentration, there's no potential health risk. If your exposure is greater than the reference concentration, there's a potential for a health risk. And again, this is only a tool to evaluate a potential risk. It does not tell you, you know, is your specific exposure making you sick or not? That's not its intent. It's just a tool to assess the potential for health risk and decide if if some kind of action is needed in terms of remediation. So we compare to a threshold of 1, and so what do we find? We looked at each individual air monitor, and hopefully you can all see that. So here's a simple bar chart, and again, I mentioned we looked at calculating the time-weighted average two different ways, one with non-detects equal to 0, and that's the blue, dark blue bars, and then we calculated using that background concentration as a proxy for the non-detect results. And that's the green bars here. And so we have each of the individual monitoring locations shown here, Maritime Museum, Maritime Store, the marina, Chesapeake Harbor, and the roadway, and then by the pool. And those are all compared. So these little numbers here are the hazard indices for each of those points. And those are compared to this dark blue line up here, which is that threshold of one. And as you can see, the hazard indices are all well below that threshold of one. So that suggests there's no risk, no health, no potential health risk. And again,
sorry, that toxicity, I'm trying to remember the three things you said.
Yep.
So the one is related to which one of those levels?
So one is, so just going back. So when we calculate a hazard quotient, it's the amount you're exposed to compared to that reference concentration.
Yeah.
It's just a simple ratio calculation. And then that's compared to one. And if you're below one, there's no potential health risk.
Detection, nuisance, or...
So there's odor threshold, so where you can smell something.
You got it.
Then there's nuisance odor, where you smell it and you don't like it, and maybe it causes some, scratchy throat or watery eyes, headache. And then there's toxicity. So is it causing damage to your lungs? Is it causing damage to your heart? Some kind of significant health effect to your vital organs.
So this is the threshold of toxicity. It's not, that one,
that's what I'm trying to figure out.
As opposed to margin, what's your middle
capsule? Nuisance.
Where is nuisance in that
one? Yeah, so this approach looks at toxicity.
Okay.
Yeah.
So again, nuisance odors, it's a really wide range, right? Like, so a level that affects you and causes your eyes to water might not affect the person sitting next to you at all. They might not even smell it. And so that's really variable, and that's something that's not assessed. So clearly we're acknowledging, there are bad odors in the area, and they can have the potential to cause watering eyes or a headache, or, maybe you just feel a little off because you don't like that smell, and your body's saying, I don't like that smell.
So there's no hazard for people with pulmonary problems?
Based on the reference concentration that we use in this, which is, again, a very conservative value that's intended to cover a broad range of the population, including...
No, this is a specific question. It's not a broad range question. If people have pulmonary problems, does this hazard quotient, is it an accurate reflection? Or is there, could there be a health risk for people with a threshold that's different than HQ1?
Well, again, this is a tool, right? So this does not tell people.
So you can't really answer the question.
I can't say, is the hydrogen sulfide making you sick? That's something you need to talk. I'm not a medical doctor. But this is a tool that's used all across US EPA and state agencies to evaluate health risks associated with chemicals, not just hydrogen sulfide and not just air. They use it as the basis for drinking water standards, air quality standards, things like that. So it's a very common approach. It's a very well accepted approach. It's been in use for decades. And again, the toxicity values that are used and the conservative assumptions that are built into the risk assessment are really intended to provide a protective overestimate of a potential risk.
So as somebody who's independent in this whole process, all the numbers and stuff, I get it. But put yourself in our shoes, somebody who is well-versed in all of this. If you are being woken up in the middle of the night by something that is obviously impacting your ability to breathe, that's impacting your eyes, it's impacting your well-being, would you feel comfortable living in that situation?
No, I wouldn't, because this assessment is looking at toxicity versus a nuisance odor, and no one's saying nuisance odor should be ignored by any means, and that's what the DPW.
But none of this is vetted by health professionals or anything like that. So what we're getting from you is the facts of the science, math, whatever. But as far as senior citizens, people with health disorders or things like that, has a doctor, does a medical professional agree that this is not toxic to those that are in more susceptible periods of their lives? I just don't understand how something that wakes you up in the middle of the night, or something that your mind your business going on about your day. day. Mm-hmm. It's, this is a weekly, monthly thing. Mm-hmm. And I can't understand how that could not be considered toxic over time.
Yeah.
Nobody's making that make sense to me.
Yeah, it's a hard concept to understand because it's not that you're, you know, a nuisance odor is causing an effect, right? You could have watery eyes or nausea or whatever that is, and no one's saying that's not happening at all. The difference is it causing a toxic effect that will cause some kind of long-term damage? So if you are exposed to a nuisance odor and the nuisance odor goes away, you recover, right? Like, so maybe you had a headache from smelling a bad smell. You remove the smell, your headache goes away. Versus you inhaled a contaminant and now you have, for example, liver damage. So there's a difference in the level of toxicity.
So you're saying over time, somebody living in this 10 years, 20 years, and it's a nuisance level, that over time it will not impact their health? Is that what you're saying?
Based on the reference concentration that we use, which is, again, a very conservative level that's intended to address health effects across a large population, including sensitive individuals, so children and adults, seniors. I've got a couple of questions here.
Can I ask you just one more question? You mentioned that basically this analysis is a tool, and as a user of data, basically different tools have different utility.
Yep.
Some tools may be highly primitive, other tools may be what I would call a so what factor.
Yeah.
You know, you tell me here's the conclusion, I say, okay, fine, so what? And what I'm trying to, you know, and I'm not a professional in the environmental sciences area by any means, but from what I'm taking away from it is if you have the nuisance factor, and as you said, there's a wide range of nuisance factors, so that it's possible, I mean, in fact, perhaps here this is the case, where you can have a nuisance factor that is 3 standard deviations above the mean, mm-hmm. way, way, way significant, but this is essentially saying, but don't worry, it won't kill you.
That's a nice way of summarizing it. But yes, so there is a nuisance condition, and that's what, you know, the DPW is working on, right? To eliminate that, to reduce those odors and make life better. This is one aspect of that, you know, and basically the reason for looking at toxicity, as you want to know, is are the levels causing a toxic effect? So again, is it causing neurological damage? Is it causing some kind of cardiovascular or respiratory damage other than these short-term effects?
Let's take one more so we can kind of move on.
And I think, okay.
I know there have been a lot of studies done on chronic exposure to noise around airports and so on. There have also been a number of studies done related to the chronic exposure to odors, mm-hmm. and have shown that there are adverse health effects beyond nuisance, inconvenience, and so on. Are you familiar with any of those?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the contaminant. It depends, again, with nuisance odors, there's such a variability in what's perceived as a nuisance by different people. Again, I think, you know, we're not trying to say that nuisance odors aren't real, they're not causing discomfort. It's, we're looking at that in terms of, you know, is it a nuisance odor that's, you know, causing these short-term effects, or is it a concentration that we need to be concerned with because it's causing long-term damage? I think for hydrogen sulfide, there's not a lot of great information on chronic exposure to to those low levels. You know, certainly, you know, sensitive subpopulations, people with asthma, perhaps they might have they might experience more effects than others would, but I don't think there's great data for hydrogen sulfide specifically.
So there's not on the pulmonary function testing. I thought it wasn't, you didn't do that type of testing, did you?
There's no, these values are that I use are EPA.
Much more general, so people with home. I'm just trying to be clear.
Yeah.
What you're saying, if people have pulmonary, there is the possibility that these thresholds would really already be could affect them. You're not saying that there's this is
right.
Really these, safe.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, this assessment doesn't tell you if you get sick because of the exposure. It talks about the potential for risk. So based on the concentrations that we're seeing, and again, you know, the air monitors were deployed for a couple of months, continuously around the clock. When you look at the range of concentrations, it's pretty low. The detection frequency, it's pretty low. So when you look at the concentrations that the neighborhood's exposed to, compared to these reference levels, it shows really that we would not expect adverse effects. Not talking about the nuisance odor issue, but toxic effects to occur as a result of exposure.
Just a real quick question. On the nuisance, you know, you do have a range from 0.5 to 300, yeah. Right?
Yep.
So on this list, based off of what we have threshold of hazard, where would nuisance be? Would that be under like 0.4? Would it be under 0.6?
I would have to, let's see, so if we can go back.
Because I mean, it's a calculation.
Right, it's and it's linear. So if we look at average concentrations for each of the different locations, that's that column. I wish I had a little, I don't know, I don't want to press the wrong thing and like turn it off. But basically that average concentration. These are sub part per billion, so less than one part per billion. And we had nuisance concentrations, you know, that threshold, that range was pretty large. So it was everything from, you know, actually what you see at the marina storefront in ranging all the way up to concentrations that you're seeing at the actual water reclamation facility. So pretty high levels. The average concentration is really actually consistent with what you would see roughly around background, maybe a little bit higher.
Right around the 0.33 background.
Yeah. So really not that much different on a, you know, when you're looking at it on a long-term basis over time, it's really similar to what you see in your background. Definitely you have individual readings, like a 10-minute reading that, you know, pops up, concentration pops up. Concentration goes down. But overall, the concentrations were pretty low.
How does that compare to a non-intense site?
We need to move along so we can get through everything. We have a 7:30 time on the week. If you have any time questions, we'll get to that.
Okay, I think this is my last slide, or maybe I have one more. But we also looked at workers at the facility as well. Use a different method to evaluate workers at the facility, and that is basically evaluating their exposure relative to standards. So workers are held to federal and state occupational safety standards. So, you know, as a worker, and you can definitely speak more to this, you know, they have to receive training, they have appropriate personal protective equipment, they might have health monitoring, things like that. So because of that, and there are levels that there are occupational health levels that air concentrations at their facility are not supposed to be greater than. So OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has what's called a permissible exposure limit of 20 parts per million. So we're looking at parts per billion in the neighborhood. At the facility, we're looking at parts per million, and that's because you're right at the source of where the hydrogen sulfide's produced. That OSHA level of 20 parts per million is a bit of an outdated level, and so a lot of facilities now are looking at a different level, 10 parts per million, and that's NIOSH, National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. And this is really trying my acronym-like brain thing. So they have an exposure limit of 10 part per million. That's typically what the facilities are, that have hydrogen sulfide as a contaminant are looking at. And so there are monitors in the facilities that are triggered when levels go above 10 part per million. And again, workers are trained to understand the risks associated with their job and with exposure to hydrogen sulfide. So that component of the risk assessment's really focused on worker safety compared to these occupational health levels. And so my last slide is just conclusions, summarizing what I've already talked about, so don't need to go in detail to this, but hydrogen sulfide, again, is very infrequently detected across the neighborhood at the monitoring locations. We did see individual readings above odor thresholds, but in general, the overall concentrations were pretty close to background, maybe a little bit higher, but definitely at levels that can cause nuisance odors, as you're all very aware of. The detected levels that we found are not expected to cause toxic effects, although they will cause nuisance odor effects. And then I think Chris is going to talk a little bit more about next steps and schedule, but you know, the DPW is definitely working on making improvements to the facility to eliminate the odor issues. And then I already talked about worker safety, so that's all I have. I don't know if you want to just keep going.
Thank you very much. Okay, so a couple more slides. Again, we have a 7:30 cutoff in the library and stuff like that. So real quick, and we'll get to more questions. So just updated schedule and next steps. So here's the updated schedule. Again, we talked about that grit scrubber chemical feed. So that's gonna be starting in early May, and hopefully by the end of May, that is totally functional. We're gonna start the air scour silencer. That's that big jet engine noise again and all that. That's gonna be starting in mid-May and all that. Again, that's the thing that came in earlier this week. So we just need a couple more pieces to get that started. The mud well construction, so that's that green area we had earlier and stuff like that. So the phase one, again, is to replace the valve and cut the areas and stuff. So that's going to start late spring, early summer. And mud well construction phase two, so that's the cover, coat, and control. So it's, again, putting a cover over the entire area and adding a odor control for that. So that's gonna start late summer. And again, that's more because of the material that takes so long to come in. Detailed design, so again, RK&K is continuing their design and is gonna wrap up this winter. Then we're gonna be starting the bidding and awarding process early 2026. Right now we're scheduled to start it January 4th or something like that. So beginning of next year and all that, we're gonna start the bidding. And the bidding is, again, to get the contractor on board to come and install the improvements we're gonna put in. So we're estimating a start of construction summer 2026. Usually our whole bidding process is about 4 to 6 months. So it just takes that long to get through the bidding process. We have to advertise it for so long and all the legal documents I have to go through. It's a whole process. So starting summer 2026, and again, finished construction, we're looking at late 2027. And again, a big portion of that is, again, the lead time on these materials. Again, these are very specialized materials that we're putting in, so they take a while to obtain.
Can I ask a question?
Why is your sign outside say completion December 20th?
That is for the phase two construction that's currently underway.
Of the clarifier, yes.
Does
that really nothing to do with it?
No. That their project was well before we kind of even started ours. They had already bidded and basically almost broke ground before we even started. So,
can you give us an idea of the impact of each of these stages on the output of nasty oil?
Yeah, right. Sure. So the grit scrubber and all that, if you remember back when we did the summer monitoring, was one of the higher concentrations we had and all that. So it's like going into this project, we already knew that system was failing. We didn't know how bad, and then we found out how bad it really was failing and stuff like that. So that one should solve a big issue we have. The other big one is the mud well and all that. That one kind of came as part of this project. We didn't know it was really a concern until we started this project. Then we saw how big of a concern it really was and stuff like that. So that's why we've expedited those. Normally, we probably would have put this into the odor improvements, but we saw how big of an issue it was. So we're expediting it as fast as we can. And we're giving it to the current phase two contractor, Global Heavy, on site to start this mud wall construction. So we're trying to do that as fast as possible and all that. So
would you say 75%? I mean, so to his question, where are you,
The two we're doing with the grit scrubber and the mud well will hit the two strongest ones that are already, that are not treated currently. So the other two that we're doing with Arcane K are already currently treated by the blowers that we use on site and all that. They take the air off of the primaries and the gravity sludge thickeners and already use that air through the aeration process and basically treat it that way. And then the influent pump station already has another odor unit that is still working functionally. So
in summary, what you're saying is when phase two of the mud well is completed, mm-hmm. we should at that point see a significant reduction.
Yes, that's what we're expecting. Yes.
So will we be able to see results from that? Will we take, what happened in the fall of 2018?
So again, we're continuing that monitoring up through construction, up through late 2027 at least, and stuff like that. So you'll hopefully be able to see it monthly as we kind of finish processes. You'll be able to see it hopefully trail down. So again, just quick next steps. Again, summary monitoring readings will be posted monthly. The first one's going to be May 9th. We're continuing the design process, starting the mud well improvements, it's the silencer for the air scour, and then finishing the repair for the odor scrubber. I'll come right back and all that. Just want to quickly go. I'm sorry. I know I want to end on that slide. I'm sorry. But here's my information and all that. If anything you have comes up afterwards and all that, feel free to contact me. Phone number, email address. I prefer email. It's usually easier for me to get back to you. Again, QR code brings you to that website. It's on the handout you have today and stuff like that. Please sign up for the email updates if you can. That way you get all these updates as we do it. Like I said, we're looking at roughly monthly, if not quarterly, at least to send some updates of what's going on, at least with the project and stuff like that. So.
And Chris, the full report that was presented on tonight, is that already on the website, as well as the fact sheet and the presentation from tonight?
Yep. Okay. I saw her in the back. Sorry. I'll come to you.
First of all, thank you. Thanks for the progress and for hopefully the government grant that's coming through to fund all this. My only question is this a Monday through Friday where you'll have construction going on, none on weekends, and is there a noise level to it during certain
So you shouldn't see any more noise level than what's kind of going on site now. If anything, the construction on site now is probably more of a noise level than you'll see with the odor control improvements and all that. They're doing much more excavation than we are planning for in our design and stuff like that. So.
And thank you for coming out tonight and meeting with us. I'm going to use your map if you don't mind.
Yeah, no problem.
I have a couple questions. My first one is, there are 8 ppb level sensors on this map, and all of the toxicology evaluation used 1 through 5, the blue ones, the 3 green circles the septic hauler, the east, and the north side. Those are also PPBV sensors, and I did not see any data for those in your report to go through the whole calculation to get to your HQ number for those PPB sensors. Did you happen to run those numbers at all?
Yeah, the focus was on the neighborhood monitoring points.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is a house right here. So I would say, and there are houses all down the street, our guard booth, which is manned 24/7, is here. And these are all houses near this PPV sensor. So I was just curious why these 3 were not included.
So those are at the fence line,
right? Right here next to the house.
Yeah, but they're also right next to
the primaries.
The Gritton Hall, the Gritton Screen Building, right. So.
Yeah, so we weren't focused on looking at the risk from sensors that were situated at the facility itself.
No, but I would consider that, I would consider these two at least neighborhood. I believe that is Baywoods there. So I would say that is kind of.
Just the other side. Maritime right there.
Oh, that's Maritime. Okay. All right. Oh, Baywoods is.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyways, my point is, we had the raw data from the Freedom of Information Act, and I did do the calculations. And assuming I did the calculations correctly, the range of numbers for your HQ value for these three sensors was 1.7 to 6.1. And according to the definition in your risk assessment, if the HQ value is greater than one, it means there is a potential health risk. So I would like to state that I think there is a potential health risk that was recorded at those PPB sensors. That's the conclusion I would come to looking at that data. And I was disappointed to see that it wasn't included in the report. My second concern question, could I possibly pull up, it might be like slide 19-ish, where you show how you treat the sensor readings of zero. Back one or two more.
Back?
Back, yeah, go back, before that. One more maybe, oh. It showed, all right. Your sensor readings of zero, your sensor readings choices were zero or three, because the detection limit of the sensors is 3 ppbv. When a sensor has a number less than three, it is putting out a number of zero, because it is below the detection limit of the sensor. I personally have never substituted numbers in for those zeros because we don't know what the number is. I would always report those zero numbers as simply less than 3 ppb. That's the detection limit of the sensor. So anything below that, you have no idea what that number is. It could be zero. It could be the 0.33, which is your background level, but it could also be 2.9 ppb. You don't know. So when you look at your frequency of detections, it's the frequency of which you hit a 3 ppbv concentration of hydrogen sulfide. All of the other readings, all you can do is say they're simply less than 3. Every one of those could have been 2.9, they could have been 2.8, they could have been 1.0. We don't know. And it's the limitation of your sensor. And that's not a personal attack. I mean, it's about as good as you're going to get on a sensor that you can use outside to run 24/7. It's a limitation of the sensor technology available today, to my knowledge. However, by going in and running a time-weighted average, using all of those zeros as zero, or using all of those zeros as 0.33, you could also run them and use all of those zeros as 2.9. If we were making up numbers of what they could possibly be, they could be 2.9. So I took the liberty of running the data that way also, and of course, the numbers got a little worse. So I redid the table in Appendix B and added some additional lines. I also added the septic hauler, the east and the north side, but I also calculated your TWA, where your zero values were now equal to 2.9, and your HQ values at 2.9. And your HQ values now range, the lowest one would be the Marina Store, which I guess is one of these, one or two. That number is 1.43. The highest number, septic hauler one here, 8.31. Chesapeake Harbor Pool and Chesapeake Harbor Roadway were 2.0, 2.14. Once again, all of those HQ numbers are over one, which to me says we don't know that there isn't a potential risk from this sensor data. We just simply don't know those numbers below two. I also took the liberty of just saying, what if every number that was recorded on that sensor was truly 2.0? So some of the numbers at specifically this number one location were recorded at 2,500. So I took the 2,500 and substituted it with 2 ppb. I took all the zeros, substituted them with 2 ppb. You still come out with an HQ value of 1.4. Which leads me to the conclusion that the sensors just aren't sensitive enough to be used as an evaluation of a potential health risk. I don't know if you'd like a copy of the table for Appendix B. I didn't have anyone check my math, I was by myself, but there's a copy of what I came up with numbers if you're interested in them. I think that's it. All right, thank you.
Yay. Thank you.
It's not fun following the ninja there.
Anyway, I do have two specific questions, one for Anne Arundel County and the Department of Public Works, and I also have a question that is to the broader community. But first, I'd like to give a little bit of background, because is your name Lisa Industrial Hutch? Okay, I wanted to give you a little background of what we've been doing for the past one plus years. We've made a lot of progress, and we really appreciate the fact that you're inviting us here to discuss this. My name is Sharon Hockenberry. I'm a homeowner here of 30 years in Anne Arundel County. I'm also a small business owner, and I'm an engaged citizen. I have an aging parent. I care about her. I care about her health. I also care about my community. I'm worried about the public health here. And I'm also a key member in the Clean Air Action Group of Anne Arundel County. This is our mascot. So I've been here at these meetings a few times in the past year and a half. And Chris, I just wanted to let you know that I really appreciate your willingness to hear us out, and especially your willingness to consider the Smell My City data in your long range plan. And I love your website, by the way. And you posted. I love it. You posted a little 2-page flyer or whatever for the Annapolis Odor Control Project. You give an overview, the actions taken to date, and you include Smell My City. I really appreciate that. I also appreciate the community, because to date we have collected data on the odor, this sensor, which is very important, over 6,500 odor complaints since we started collecting the data. I'm really here right now to urge Anne Arundel County to address what I'm calling the elephant in the room. We've touched on it a little bit, and that's the air quality oversight. I believe that we need an agency that has authority over Anne Arundel County and DPW, because without permanent, and that goes beyond when everything's installed and everything, without permanent monitoring of hydrogen sulfide and other potentially harmful chemicals, we will never solve this problem long term. I've been here 30 years. It was a problem when I came here 30 years ago, but I was a software engineer for Oracle. I was never home. COVID brought me home. An aging parent brought me home. Now I'm home all the time, and I'm watching my neighbors get sick. We also don't want to we don't want to have this conversation again in 5 or 10 years. And worse yet, we don't want to hand this problem over to the next generation. So we are problem solvers, as you can tell by Sharon Costigan. Like, she's brilliant. So we have a proposed solution that we would like to propose to you. Our group of, and we're all volunteer, We took a data-driven, community-engaged approach to solving this public health problem. We've developed a powerful tool to track and monitor and analyze both Smell My City data and raw sensor data on a single platform, and we've configured it to refresh hourly and send mobile alerts whenever we have hotspots, say for example, the filters aren't cleaned or whatever, and we have problems with the odor. We've set it up so that there are business rules where we can say if we have more than 10 level 4 or level 5 odor complaints from the community, it can trigger an alert to the manager on call or you and take it up the chain and allow you guys to remediate the problem. So we've been working on this. We're really proud of it. We started off with the door hanger, engaging our community to use the app. We also have a Facebook page. We're encouraging people to collect data there. Here is one day's map of the odor reports. Here's our dashboard. We've integrated it with the raw sensor data. And we also have, which I'm excited about this too, we have a strategic partner in Central Florida who is, they're having the same problem we're having. We're sharing data with them, they're sharing data with us, and we're trying to solve the problem together. They're the ones who gave us the pathway to get the raw sensor data. But what I'm offering to you is, I need to turn this over. Lisa, if you can get us funding for a summer intern, I would love to turn this over, and I'm free of charge, work with you guys, integrate it into your awesome website so that those alerts can help the community and we can establish trust with the community so that they know if there is a problem that it'll be resolved and that you guys are watching it. So you can have this. I need to get back down to Florida because I still have my stuff in storage since March of 2020. And I have an intern down there too. But we would love to hand this over to you and work with you to solve the problem long term. And I hate to say there's a catch or a condition. I don't like to do that. But the catch is that I'll speak for myself right now, we do expect, we're going to insist, I'm going to say, on air quality accountability to ensure that odor monitoring and possibly effluent water testing, such as PFAS, because that's a byproduct of wastewater processing, we want them to be included in the permit. We agreed to the terms defined by MDE in the permit renewal, and I understand that you guys don't want to do that, but I believe that you owe us an answer on where that'll happen. We need oversight somewhere. If it's not in the permit, it's gotta be somewhere. So I'm gonna go ahead and close with the two questions I have. And also, in this tool that we would love to give you, we're also tracking behavioral health and quality of life factors, such as fatigue, anxiety, that type of thing. But the question to Anne Arundel County and DPW is, just given one day of odor reports, one day, what level of odor are you asking us to tolerate? I want to know that. Like, are we saying, like, there's over 60 reports here. Are you saying if it's in one day 30 that's acceptable? Because it's not to me. It's not, one dark red triangle is too much, in my view. So that's to the county and DPW. And then to the community, what level of odor are you willing to tolerate? Because that should be one answer. We need to collaborate on an answer. What are we willing to tolerate? And I believe that's where we are. Thank you. Thank you.
I just have a question. For the independent environmental scientists, every meeting that we've attended, we've been provided statistics. And every meeting, these amazing ladies provide counter statistics that are in our community's favor.
unfortunately, they're not good statistics for our health. As the independent person in the room, are you going to go back and look at this data that they're providing? Is the report going to look different? How is that going to be reflected back to us?
Well, I'll discuss with DPW, but I mean, you know, I acknowledge the limitations of the PPD sensor, but I believe is an assumption that, as you're saying, the detection limit is 3 parts per million. So if it, you know, it's less than 3, if it's a 0, we don't know what that number is. My assumption is that in lieu of picking an arbitrary number below 3, I went based on what a background concentration would be. So is it, you know, 0.33? Is it 0.34? Is it 0.1? Is it 0? I don't know, but I made that simplifying assumption. So yes, you can make many different assumptions, and when we do risk assessments, we make a lot of assumptions. We make assumptions about how often somebody is exposed. You know, I made the assumption that somebody's in their house 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Is that an accurate assumption? For some people it might be. For many, it's probably not. You're going to work or school or whatever. So these assumptions go into this risk assessment framework, and that gives you an indication of the need for action. And obviously, that, you know, separate from the odor issue, there is a need for action, and the DPW is working towards that. But as far as reevaluating, you know, it's off the top of the DPW, the one who's doing anything about that. I did avoid those monitoring locations at the water reclamation facility. They have much higher concentrations. They're taken right by, in many instances, right at or right near different parts of the processes, so they would have naturally higher readings. The neighborhood monitoring locations are representative of the areas people are living at. I'm not convinced that fence line monitor concentration is the same concentration that you find in somebody's backyard. So that's sort of a different issue in evaluating, you know, air quality in different locations around the facility. And that's certainly one you can certainly talk to the team about. But for risk assessment purposes and looking at neighborhood monitoring locations, I don't feel that's representative.
Have you seen the fence line? Have you seen the neighborhood that is right across the street from that?
Yep.
I mean, that is somebody's backyard. So it's very frustrating coming to these meetings, and each meeting we get these statistics that are always refuted. I don't know who to believe when you're standing up there giving us data, because I always wait for the people who live with me, who live in my community, who have my vested interests at heart. And it seems like we come here, and we're still at the same point as far as the odor and our health. And if there is somebody independent who's supposed to be in the middle looking at both sides, I would really like to have factual information that represents both sides, or the facts, period, just the facts.
Okay. We have time for one more question.
I think there were people when I asked in the winter time, and that was that we have the self-reported data from the Smell My City app. When I looked at the frequency of events, like 2% or 4%, I know how much I'm on this app reporting smells. And so I'm shocked to see a very low number in that 6-week period. I would really love to see some sort of, you know, I know it's self-reported data, but is there a spike in reports that correlates in any way with a higher number of events that are being picked up by the monitors? You know, clearly the monitors aren't picking up everything that we're able to with our noses, but oh my goodness, it's much more than 2 to 4% events over a 6-week period.
And speaking for the Annapolis Maritime Museum, we feel like it's getting more frequent and
yes,
more intense. You know, that was a tiny window there, but in the last months, it's impacting us in a myriad of ways.
And I just avoid walking, I just stay in short walks around, but you should be able to walk down the street and into the park, but it smells so bad, you don't want to.
And again, we agree with that and all that, and that's why we're moving forward with the improvements as fast as we can and stuff like that. So I want to thank you for your time. Unfortunately, we do have to get out of here and all that. Library is great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pretty sure we had to last time, so.